All right, everybody's a glutton for punishment. They came back, huh? Well, let's take our Bibles and open them to the book of Exodus, chapter 2 and verse 24. He mentioned the Spirit and Truth website. I pastor a local church, so if you're interested in my sermons, you can get them all at going back to 2010 when I started there. I've taught Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, John. We were in John for 3 years, which is as long as Christ's ministry, basically. But you can get all those at a website called Sugarland Bible Church, www.slbc.org. www.slbc.org. With that website and the Spirit and Truth website, you pretty much kept up to date on all my stuff that I've been doing. If you download an app called Sermon Audio, has anybody seen Sermon Audio? Okay. I'm on that too. It's just a matter of getting that from the App Store for free. And then once you get in there, you can put our church name in, Sugarland Bible, one word, in that particular search engine, and all our stuff should pop up as well. So it's kind of neat in this world of technology that we're living in, although all this technology is probably going to bring in the kingdom of the Antichrist. At least we can use it for good things, right, while we're still here on the earth. This session, what I was trying to do is give you the big picture in the prior session, and in the next three sessions, today, we're going to be dealing with different facets of the kingdom. We're looking at here, are the biblical covenants eternal? Because what you're going to say is great information, great presentation. However, my amillennial replacement theologian friend says this. Or my amillennial or replacement theologian pastor says that. And so what I'm going to try to do is expose you to the arguments that they use. There's about 8 of them. They use these over and over and over again. And if it's tossed at you and you're not really equipped to handle it, it can throw you off. But all of these things that they toss our way have a very easy answer. So you all know what I mean by an amillennialist, right? Or a replacement theologian. Basically what they are saying is the church has permanently replaced Israel. So we are the new Israel in their thinking. All of Israel's blessings have been transferred to the church. Now, you notice they never transfer the curses to the church? We'll leave those behind with the Jewish people. We'll take all the blessings. So they sort of spiritualize the text to do that. And in the process, they're saying Israel is finished as a nation. And then you say, well, what about 1948? Isn't that a precursor? Didn't God bring the Jewish people back into the land to fulfill His word? And they say, oh, that's just a coincidence. That's just a fluke. They attach no significance at all to Israel in the Middle East. And matter of fact, many of them, I've seen denominations actually involved in denominational boycotts of Israel. So this is a tragic thing that's happened theologically. And this replacement theology really began to kick into high gear with Augustine in his book, The City of God, which was written around the 4th century. And that's your first written formal treatment of amillennialism in church history. And Augustine is the most influential theologian in church history for the negative, not for positive. And he's the one with some other historical forces that has put the church under this sort of amillennial spell that the church really didn't start to crawl out of until the time of the Reformation. And even then, the reformers just were literal in some areas. And it really wasn't until the Bible Church movement, men like John Nelson Darby, C.I. Schofield, Blackstone, a number of them we could mention, that began to take the Reformers' hermeneutic and apply it to the whole Bible. The Reformers taught literal interpretation unless an obvious figure of speech is present in the text. And once the church did that, our viewpoint came back into full swing. So it's an ancient battle that we're in here, this replacement theology versus the kingdom that's coming presentation, which I gave in the last hour. But just by way of review, we've seen the Abrahamic covenant, did we not? And why it's necessary. It was necessary because all the other nations had been corrupted with the mother-child cult. Remember we studied that in the last hour? So God is not going to use the Assyrians or the Phoenicians or the Egyptians. They're all involved in this mother-child cult. He's going to raise up a new nation. And that's why God is irate when you read Jeremiah 44 and Ezekiel 8. You'll see that the mother-child cult in the days of those prophets actually came into the borders of Israel. They started to worship the Queen of Heaven and Tammuz. And God is irate at this because Israel was set up to be a light against this very thing. So God raised up Israel independent of the mother-child cult. And then when Israel becomes just like the other nations around her, God is very angry with His people, and that's why He put them into discipline for 70 years. But anyway, God is going to use this man Abram because all of the other nations have been corrupted. As we studied, He called Abram out of the Ur of the Chaldeans, told him to walk by faith, gave him certain promises. Genesis 12, 1 through 3 begins to describe those promises. And then finally, those promises get ratified in the form of an official covenant. The Hebrew word for covenant is berith, and that's the word used in Genesis 15 and verse 18. In that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. Now, to analogize it to modern terms, a covenant is a contract. You can think of it that way. God entered into a contract with His people. The prophets were raised up for purposes of covenant enforcement. They were saying, look, Israel, you haven't been faithful to the covenant, the Mosaic covenant. So a covenant, by definition, has to be literal, doesn't it? In your mortgage agreement, can you interpret that allegorically? It has to be literal terms. So when you understand this as an actual covenant that has to be enforced, everything has to be construed according to the ordinary sense of language, or else how do you tell if someone is in breach of contract? So God gave Abram this covenant of land, seed, and blessing. The land is a tract of real estate from modern-day Egypt to modern-day Iraq. We know that this will be fulfilled one day because God cannot, what? He cannot lie. Now, the land and seed and blessings, in fact, I had you turn to Exodus, but just very quickly, take a look at Genesis 15. Genesis 15 and verse 18 says, on that day, the Lord made a covenant, berith, with Abram. That's a huge statement there. So God is covenantally, contractually obligating Himself to do certain things. One of the things He promises to give to Abram is innumerable seed. And you see that in verse 5. He took him outside and said, now look towards the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. By the way, isn't it interesting that all these scientists throughout the ages have thought the stars could be counted? And it's not until the invention of modern, like the Hubble telescope and things like that, that we've discovered that this universe is so vast, man can't count the stars. And isn't it interesting how ahead of the curve the Bible is, scientifically? Go ahead and try, Abram, count the stars, if you can do it. Ha ha. So man has always felt the stars could be counted. God always knew that they couldn't, because God is the creator of the universe. It's just too big a number for man. But He took him outside and said, now look, Abram, towards the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. And He said, so shall your descendants be. So there's your promise of seed. If you go to verse 1, he says, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not fear. I am a shield to you. Your reward will be very great.'" There's your promise of personal blessing.